I'm Rusty Reno, and I'm the editor of First Things Magazine. And my job is just to sort of launch these folks and then to oversee a conversation at the end. So Jennifer's going to start us off with why we do not need to be religious in order to be happy. Jennifer, please.
Okay, so the question is, can we have happiness without religion? It's not really a perennial question, since secularism is a relatively newfangled way of thinking and living for us human beings. But it's definitely a question for us, especially those of us living in North America and Europe, where none is the second largest religious affiliation, an affiliation whose numbers continue to grow as the more traditional affiliations decline. It's also a deeply practical and existential question that affects how we organize our lives and how we understand ourselves. I hope it's obvious that I'm not going to give a definitive answer to this question. It's a hard question. So instead, I'd just like to provide something like a framework for addressing and thinking about the question, and I will tentatively put forward the claim that there is, in fact, such a thing as non-trivial, relatively stable happiness for secular people of goodwill, and that this sort of happiness will seem to these people to suffice given their other beliefs and commitments, especially about human beings and their place in the natural world. Furthermore, I think it's relatively easy to see that a secular happiness is genuinely worth pursuing. And we can say of the persons who actually manage to attain such happiness that they are good and decent people leading good and decent human lives. Now, whether such persons are living the best sort of human life possible is not a question that I'm going to attempt to answer. My claim is more limited, but I think it's still worth insisting upon, namely that secular people can be robustly happy. And we don't have to say that. We don't have to commit ourselves either way to whether or not they're the happiest. Okay, so in order to argue for this position, like any philosopher, I'm just going to start making distinctions and getting clear about my terms. So let's start with religion and what I don't mean by religion. First, I don't mean organized religion in the sense that picks out a body of doctrine and practice that's established and enforced by some kind of hierarchical or bureaucratic form of institutional management or control. Second, I don't mean religion in the sense that picks out some comprehensive philosophical or theological doctrine that attempts to answer the big questions in life, like how ought I to live, what should I believe, or what's the meaning of life. Third, I don't mean religion as an object of speculative inquiry, as you might encounter it at a secular university like NYU, especially if you're hanging around departments of religious studies, psychology, or anthropology. And finally, I don't mean religion to refer to those kind of quasi-mystical experiences of the ineffable or the transcendent, the stuff you hear about in backpacking trips in the mountains, where one comes back and speaks of feeling at peace with the universe and connected to all things. I don't have any quarrel with these uses of religion. I think they're perfectly legitimate and familiar enough. I just happen to find them useless for addressing our question, so I'm just going to set them aside. Instead, I want to focus on the use of religion in a less familiar, but I think ultimately important sense, and that's religion as a virtue that's defined by certain acts, acts that render what is due to the source of all being, in other words, God, grasped under the description, the first principle of creation. Religion in this sense is sometimes called true religion and was classically understood as a virtue whose intelligibility came from shared practices of worship and devotion. Now, talking about religion as a virtue, I think is important to our question, since I take it that the virtues are necessary for any genuine, relatively stable, non-trivial sense of human happiness. The philosophical tradition that I spend my time defending, the broadly Aristotelian tradition, where that includes Thomism, treats virtue as a stable disposition to act in certain ways that make its possessor good by making his or her actions good. Now, the virtues perfect a human being's natural powers, thereby allowing him or her to attain genuine, real human goods in common with other human beings. Real goods like family, friendship, knowledge, etc. And in attaining these goods, to really live well and experience happiness. Now, Aristotle distinguishes between different kinds of virtues, the intellectual and the moral. The intellectual virtues perfect our capacity for knowledge, and the moral virtues perfect our desires and our emotions. Now, Aquinas takes on this Aristotelian framework, but he adds a distinction between the acquired virtues and the infused virtues. Acquired virtues are basically what we can attain through our own natural abilities, working cooperatively with others, and participating in shared practices, whereas infused virtues depend upon God's grace and our cooperation with it. Right? So the infused virtues are things like faith, hope, and love. It's interesting to note that Aquinas takes religion to be an acquired rather than an infused virtue. It's maybe somewhat surprising, and a moral rather than an intellectual virtue. In fact, Aquinas relates religion to justice because religion concerns what is owed to a superior who is worthy of being honored. The virtue of religion consists of interior acts of devotion and prayer and exterior acts of adoration, sacrifice, oblation, tithes, and vows. Now, Aquinas takes this view of religion straight from the pagans. In fact, in his treatise on religion in the Summa, he just gives a definition straight from Cicero. And so, religion's status as a virtue doesn't depend on Christian revelation. Like all acquired virtues, it concerns a sphere of human goodness that can be grasped through the use of natural reason alone and practiced competently through human efforts. Now, of course, Aquinas thinks that religion is essential to happiness. And here again, I think he's following the pagans. In fact, he says that religion is the chief of all the moral virtues, precisely because it directs all other acts of virtue to God as an end, as worthy of being so honored through these excellent acts. Now, given that Aquinas clearly believes in God and believes that we can know that God exists through the use of our natural reason alone, it makes sense that he thinks that all of virtue ought to be so directed. But what about those of us who do not believe in God? Obviously, Aquinas would have been shocked by the rise of atheism and secularism among the most educated and cultured members of Western society. But given that so many seemingly reasonable and decent people do not believe in God and do not practice religion, can we really continue to think with Aquinas that they are cut off from happiness and virtue altogether? I don't think there's really any way to answer this without saying something about what happiness is, so let's turn to that now. In common English usage, happiness is a pretty light word of little substance, but since it's a word we're basically stuck with, I'll go ahead and keep using it, but not in a very light way. People often think of happiness subjectively, as some kind of lasting state of your psychology, kind of like just feeling happy from a first-person perspective. And when psychologists try to measure happiness, they just ask you, how happy have you been feeling lately? Kind of happy? Really happy? Ecstatically happy? And now, among these, we can make further distinctions. You have hedonistic accounts, which understand happiness in terms of individual pleasures, whereas you might find life satisfaction views, which equate happiness with kind of a general attitude of being satisfied with how things are going for you on the whole. Other views focus on a person's overall emotional condition or well-being. Now, some philosophers, psychologists, and economists want to contrast happiness understood so subjectively with an objective account, where the latter marks off what makes for a happy or a good life rather than a positive subjective experience. The contrast is often marked because it seems true that one might objectively be living well, without feeling very happy or positively about how things are going, perhaps because of bad luck, or perhaps because living well in a robustly moralized sense can be pretty demanding and not always especially fun. Now, I find the purely subjective psychological sense of happiness too shallow. It leaves us unable to say why the pursuit of happiness is an excellent one, since a wicked or a trivial person might experience a great deal of questionable pleasures and fail to experience deeper ones. And we can easily imagine that such people might feel pretty satisfied with their lives on the whole. We can call such people happy, but we'd certainly feel the urge to qualify what we mean in a way that registers our disapproval. But I also think that a purely objective account of happiness is problematic. While it's true that sometimes life can be cruel and harsh, even to the virtuous person, we should hold out some hope that in a general way, an objectively good human life will bring some kind of subjectively positive benefits. Even when the going gets tough, you should at least feel good that your character remained uncorrupted. And it would be strange if the happy life turned out to be subjective torture. And it would make it an open question whether happiness was really worth pursuing. And that would be a really disastrous result if, like me, you really do think that all people basically want to be happy, and that this very natural desire plays an essential role in explaining what human beings are up to. Now, some further distinctions will help us bring the subjective and objective elements of happiness together into a single account. And again, I'm going to draw on Aquinas. I think we ought to separate a material and a formal conception of happiness. Now, formally, Aquinas thinks of happiness in terms of what can completely satisfy our capacity for rational desires. So that's our human capacity to will. Happiness in this sense is just being fully sated, which comes by way of possessing the universal good. Being sated has a clear subjective component and is psychologically real, but this satisfaction only comes by way of possessing what is truly or objectively good for human beings. Now, this formal conception of happiness, it's formal because I haven't said anything about what these goods are or what will really sate you. This formal conception of happiness is deployed in Aquinas' account of human action and free choice. Basically, Aquinas argues that wanting things in a rational way, that is to say, in accordance with your judgments about what you ought to want, depends on your ability to judge what to do here and now against some general vision of how to live well or be happy on the whole. And this substantive vision is what Aquinas thinks a material conception of happiness is, the goods that one thinks will satisfy in life, subjectively speaking. Now, one's material conception of happiness, some specific vision of the good life, will appear to the person who holds it as true, and part of that truth is such a vision is believed to be worth realizing, and that such a life will in fact be a satisfactory one. But of course, sometimes appearances can be deceiving, and one might have a hopelessly false vision. But one has to have some vision, Aquinas thinks, in order to make decisions and act rationally at all. Now, Aquinas further distinguishes between perfect and imperfect happiness. Imperfect happiness corresponds to those regions of human goodness that we can attain for ourselves through our own natural capacities. This is the stuff of the acquired virtues, virtues like prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. It's the happiness we can have in this life, the happiness we can share with others so long as reasonably sound modes of social interaction maintain themselves. Now, Aquinas also famously thinks we can have more than this, that we can also participate in God's eternal life by attaining the beatific vision. But to be able to attain that, we need to develop the infused virtues, and these depend on God's grace. So we can't have this perfect happiness on our own, and we can't have this perfect happiness in this life. Now, this second kind of happiness, perfect happiness, is supposed to surpass nature. It's also supposed to be something that, once you have it, cannot be lost. This will already rub lots of people the wrong way, as they will suspect that it is mere fantasy to think of anything beyond nature, let alone perfect happiness beyond nature, something that can't be lost. Such persons will accept our finitude and the contingency and instability that comes with it, and will take it to be a sign of immaturity to continue to want something more. In short, for a secular person, imperfect happiness not only suffices, it's all that it's reasonable to hope for. Now, such people interest me a great deal. I was raised to be among them. And as an academic at a secular state school, most of the people that I call colleagues and friends operate under a militantly secular material conception of happiness and do not possess or desire the virtue of religion. Now, some of these people are miserable, but many of them seem to be doing just fine. And some of them are really decent, amazing people who are non-trivially, but perhaps imperfectly happy. And are happy to recognize that they're imperfectly happy. That is, for them, all that there is, all that they want. And moreover, it's worth noting that plenty of people who participate in religious practices are very miserable, bad people. So what are we to make of this? I think really all we can do is kind of redefine the debate a little bit and ask ourselves whether or not we can settle for imperfect happiness. I think that given certain beliefs about human beings and the natural world, it is reasonable. But I know that Father Thomas Joseph disagrees, so I'll hand it over to him now.
I find myself in a paradoxical situation because Professor Frey has eloquently employed the arguments of Thomas Aquinas to argue that a human being can be happy without being religious. And to counter her, I have chosen, in fact, to appeal to another important Christian author primarily, and that's St. Augustine of Hippo, who weighs in on this question in intriguing and incisive ways in the book The City of God, which does in some ways inspire Augustine, and in other ways inspires deeply Pascal. I've given you a handout with some citations from them and some cartoon illustrations. St. Augustine understands religion to be primarily an infused virtue stemming from the infused grace of charity, the love of God poured into our hearts by the Holy Spirit. And I am, in fact, starting, therefore, from a slightly different vantage point and thinking about the satisfaction of the human heart that's acquired through the grace of divine love as the principle of religion. So let's begin where Augustine does by considering the non-rational animals. Can they be said to be happy or unhappy? In the Aeneid, Plotinus says anything that's alive, even a plant, can be said to be happy in some sense if it enjoys an equilibrium in life. And that to deny this of the plants is to deny that life has an intrinsic harmony or purpose or meaning or intelligibility. Augustine often follows Plotinus, and in his own maybe more metaphysically modest way, he makes a similar claim. In an analogical sense, yes, animals can be said to be happy or unhappy insofar as they experience well-being of a physical or even emotional sort. It's not a strange question to ask in an attenuated analogical sense, if this dog here is happy, is it doing well? Augustine notes that the non-rational animals, quote, desire nothing beyond the proper arrangements of the parts of the body and the satisfaction of the appetites, that is to say, bodily comfort and the right measure of pleasures, that the peace of the body might contribute to the peace of the soul. Animals, by shunning pain, show that they love bodily peace. Their shrinking from death is a sufficient indication of their intense love of that peace which binds soul and body in close alliance. Now, I think to that statement, we might also add with Aristotle that the non-rational animals instinctively desire the good of their species and seek to perpetuate it, and that this form of thriving also is intrinsic to their happiness. Now, such happiness may be modest, and although somewhat like the happiness we seek psychologically as ourselves being animals, also in other ways very different from ourselves. Just as living things that are not human are real and are subject to flourishing, but they don't seem to be subject to quite the same kinds of flourishing that we are. We are different from these creatures because we avidly pursue happiness through rational deliberation, even in all of our free actions, such that every act we pose is in some way, however banal a way, motivated most fundamentally by the desire for happiness and fulfillment through the means of reason. That's different from saying that we understand well what happiness is or know well how to procure it. Augustine underscores how fragile human happiness really is in this world, elusive, ephemeral, and when we find it, limited. On the other hand, our desire for happiness is inextinguishable and vivid. On the other hand, that desire for happiness can become often a source of disquiet and even torment, at the very least, perpetual restlessness. The desire for happiness frequently gives rise to serious disappointment. Think about that. The animals can be satisfied with so much less. We are so easily deeply dissatisfied. It can even humiliate us to desire happiness so avidly because we become deeply worried or convinced that we have failed in life to be genuinely happy, whereas others have succeeded. It seems sometimes to humiliate our reason to have to admit we took a serious wrong turn, or that something has happened that's irreversible and has marked our life forever in such ways that we've been deprived of happiness we would have wanted. We call that tragedy, and it's something we deeply fear. So the desire to be happy or appear happy gives rise to various forms of ambition and self-deception. And Augustine, with a psychological insight that is at least as helpful as that of Friedrich Nietzsche's, notes that we tell ourselves and others important lies or half-truths about how happy we really are, and that we seek to demonstrate this through various mediums, from philosophical arguments to external postures, like Facebook posts or annual family Christmas letters. No one ever writes in the annual Christmas letter, "This year Alice had a serious operation and had to confront for the first time her genuine fear of death. She is currently taking anti-anxiety medication and is in counseling." But you could imagine the litany of the entire family having those kinds of things in it. Well, just once it would be refreshing to see, wouldn't it? They're all lying. Sorry, that's a little too strong. They're concealing. They're manifesting and posturing. And you and I do it too. We take refuge in the public vanities of career, the accomplishments of our children, of the private distractions of pleasure and leisure, claiming that we have fulfilled the canonical obligations of our society and our peer group that should make us officially successfully happy. We settle for too little, and in fact conceal our deeper unresolved frustrations. And this act of self-deception, in fact, suggests a profound form of self-antipathy or self-refusal, insofar as we resist confronting our deeper, more genuinely fractured selves, wherein our desire for happiness is unresolved, and we live in confusion and doubt. Blaise Pascal writes about the positive benefits of admitting the deep imperfection and limits of our happiness in this world. Blaise Pascal thinks, in some ways, this is a doorway in to discovering something important. Our failure to find anything other than very imperfect, unsatisfying forms of happiness in creatures is the negative side of very good news, or you might say, a very real opportunity. If we admit this truth, we can begin to acknowledge the possibility of genuine happiness with God. Pascal argues in response to Montaigne that the religionist is not the person who is naive and escapist, but the only person who is actually in the end being a realist. We do genuinely wish to be happy. That's inevitable and difficult. So let's be realists and long for something we can actually possess: life with God and friendship with God. This is a real existential possibility by the grace of Christ, and it can endure forever and never be diminished or lost, because God is eternal and the soul is immaterial and lives on after death in possession of God. Now, of course, here we might wish to cough politely like J. Alfred Prufrock and think quietly to ourselves, this is not realistic. this is not worth risking even considering believing in. Or by contrast, we might briefly consider Aquinas' version of this Augustinian argument. Now, negatively, Aquinas argues thus in summary form. Wealth cannot make us happy in the end because we procure wealth as a means and not an end. Wealth provides a horizon, new horizons of possibilities, but it always also forces us to ask anew, okay, now what do we do with our money? And by the way, the world's full of retired millionaires who are restless and remorseful. Glory and fame cannot make us happy. They are radically contingent goods by their very nature and are transitory and unstable. They could spike our interests and fulfill our hearts in some ways momentarily, but they're going to be lost. To be famous, for example, you need other people to agree to look at you in a certain way continually so as to procure satisfaction of your vanity or self-love for a continual, perpetual time. The problem is they might stop paying attention to you at any moment, and this is why famous people need Twitter accounts. They're procuring actual goodness for themselves by continually stimulating the audience to turn their head. Now, power is not a good candidate because power is morally indifferent. A person can have a great deal of power and do great wickedness with it. In fact, it's not so rare that the two come together. So it's like wealth. It's more a means than an end. You might have a good deal of power, and you might make yourself happy if you use your power well. But toward what end ought you to use it? What about the physical goods of the body? Will the perfect diet and exercise routine finally make me happy when I'm the most healthy person in Manhattan? No. For if that were the case, people would be content in Manhattan simply with being healthy, and no healthy person in Manhattan would be unhappy. That is clearly not the case. I don't know the percentage of people in counseling in Manhattan compared to the rest of the world, but I know it's high. What about pleasure as the source of happiness? Ah, pleasure. Now that seems like a good candidate. Pleasures make us happy. Yes, Aquinas says, but here he makes a distinction. That's what they always do, those Thomists, they make distinctions. Pleasures of the senses give temporary joy and rest to our sensate animal life, our felt psychology, you might say, and they can be intense and important. But human beings also aspire to other forms of goods that are not simply sensible. Friendship, profound interpersonal love and appreciation, justice, but also truth, understanding, authentic perspective on the meaning of things, artistic skill, practical wisdom. So reducing all that down to sensate pleasures is not just unreasonable, it's existentially impossible. Gregory of Nyssa says you can go out and sate all the sense pleasures, and then in 20 minutes later, you'll need to figure out something else to do with yourself. Now this means we're getting close. True happiness for Aquinas consists in the stable possession of various forms of authentic goods like those just listed, true friendship, a life of personal love, justice, and so forth. Now this is the life of virtue, which Professor Frey makes reference to, toward which the health of the body and the pleasures of the senses can be oriented and in which they can be deeply integrated, as when parents, as animals to other animals, nourish their children, but do so motivated by personal love as well as a sense of justice, and not merely by animal instinct, however significant their animal instincts are. Notice what we need to make appeals to here for happiness, a certain intensity of human flourishing and a certain stability of possession, to have an authentic good and to have it in a lasting way. But what such higher good or good, or combination of goods or good can we pursue virtuously that really provides us with genuine lasting happiness, a happiness that will really satiate our desires, so that we are not subject to misery? Friendship, marriage, career, children. And Aquinas actually says, no, none of these grants us either sufficient intensity of fulfillment or perennial possession, that is to say, stable freedom from systemic disenchantment, so that it could really satisfy adequately all the thirsts of the soul for fulfillment. Even though these are genuine goods, they are imperfect goods. So he even concludes that no created good really suffices in the end, and that this is, although something that makes us in a way miserable, very good news. The reason has to do with the positive side of Aquinas' argument, The human animal is different from those other animals because we have a spiritual intellect. That's to say, we're open to the universal horizon of being, to all that exists. Likewise, we are also capable of loving all that it is, that all that exists, insofar as it is in some way good. We can have a universal appreciation and intense love or contemplation for all that exists and all that is good. This argument involves several steps, but basically Aquinas argues that if we are able to know and love all finite being, this is because on a deeper level we are open intellectually not only to what is finite, but also to the transcendent and infinite, God, the author of all that exists. God is the perfectly intensive infinite good, and since we are structurally, kapax dei, capable of God, we are likewise structurally incapable of ever being fully satisfied by the finite created good. To conclude, I might note a final objection. You and I can realize without little work that we cannot cross the abyss that stands between ourselves and the unsolvable enigma of God, if God exists. Given that fact, the desire for God may seem like a pointless want. Smart people, then, could say to themselves, we should confine ourselves to the humble cell of agnosticism and the reasonable non-religious asceticism of living for the goods of this world. To which the follower of Christ responds, no, that is not true. The human being can come to know God by grace, and in grace can come to recognize true happiness, or the invitation to true happiness, which begins in friendship with God by charity, the love of God poured into our hearts by the Holy Spirit. The contemplative discovery of God is the beginning of true peace that gives genuine rest to the soul, a peace that the world cannot take away. That is a religious answer to a philosophical question. But of course, if human beings cannot achieve their true happiness without God, then the religious answer is precisely what is needed. Thank you.
We've heard very eloquent and powerful discussion of religion as an acquired virtue, a cultivated virtue that helps to organize and order human life. And we've heard very eloquent and powerful discussion of infused religion, religion as a gift of grace to us. In typically flat-footed fashion, I'm actually going to talk about the organized institutional ones that are, you know, at best a mixed lot, okay? unlike most people who are much smarter than I am, I worry a little about the thought that we're all utterly committed to pursuing happiness, so I'm going to raise a doubt there too. When Father Thomas Joseph sent an only slightly joking email to the two of us about how best to organize this conference, he was like, here's how it should go. Frey, yes. Father Thomas Joseph, no. Vogler, it's complicated. Sadly, we're all true to form in this. Okay. I am doubly disadvantaged in a debate about happiness and religion and what, if anything, the two have to do with one another. I mean, first off, at least in my ordinary understanding, again, flat-footed, religion may cover a lot of very different forms of organized human activity, and I don't know much about most of them. I know something about some forms of Christianity. I know a little about Judaism. I know a little about Afro-Caribbean and Afro-Brazilian syncretic religious practices, and a tiny bit about a handful of Native American religious practices, and a very little bit about very small areas of Islam. And I don't know how to give a properly philosophical characterization of the nature of religion that seems applicable to all of these. It's a pretty varied group. So, largely from ignorance, in discussing religion, I'm going to have in mind socially organized spiritual practice that tends to be monotheistic, whether or not it operates with a shared body of doctrine, and whether or not its practitioners produce theology or philosophy in connection with their religious practices. So that's the first hitch, religion. The second place that I get a little hitch is around questions about happiness. Our topic is whether a presumably mature human being, presumably with her wits about her, needs religion in order to be happy, at least happy in her embodied mortal life. Now, you've got a handout from me that just gives the longer version of a quote I'm about to abbreviate. Happiness, as Philippa Foot once put it, quote, is a protean concept appearing now in one way and now in another, close quote. So, having first restricted my constituency to sane human beings in that space of life between early adulthood and that such time at the end of life as might be happy, it helps to try to wrestle happiness into more definite shape. And here I'm going to be going over ground that's been slightly covered ahead. Nowadays, it's common among Anglophone philosophers to distinguish accounts of happiness that treat happiness as a psychological concept, perhaps having to do with positively charged emotional states, or with an overall sense of satisfaction with one's life, or with a tendency to enjoy things, or with some favored combination of those. From accounts of happiness that stress human flourishing or thriving, the sorts of things that Jennifer was calling objective accounts. Which may or may not be associated with contentment or satisfaction and need not involve any particularly sunny affective tone. Although thinkers far greater than I have held that people in general pursue happiness, it's not clear what sorts of things might be involved in pursuing happiness understood in any of the usual psychological senses, and one worries that the quickest route to these will be pharmacological. Neither is it clear that flourishing accounts are picking out a single sort of target to home in on. Suppose that I think that no one should be satisfied when much of her community is torn by violence and sunk in poverty. I'm coming from Chicago. Okay. Flourishing, suppose that I'm that person. Flourishing, I think, will require engaging with my community in ways that are likely to be uncomfortable, unsatisfying, and possibly perilous as well. Now, it could be objected that I have it all wrong about flourishing, but it's hard to deny that mine could be a good human life in the end, a life well spent, a life well worth living. If so, then people like me could flourish without having a whole lot of, feel good. In the more distant past, European philosophers have varied wildly in their accounts of what happiness might be, on the understanding that the term happiness is supposed to serve as a name for what makes life good. Health, wealth, honor, sybaritic delight, ethically permissible satisfaction of all and only those of my desires that I welcome, internally peaceful and socially harmonious participation in pursuit of common good, faring well to exactly the extent to which I am acting well, all of these and more have been offered up as the kind of happiness that makes an adult human being's life good. Now, some will argue with Aquinas and Augustine and Father Thomas Joseph White that health, wealth, honor, and sensual delight cannot possibly be the stuff of the kind of happiness that makes human life good. It has been common to insist that going for these things is a matter of failing to side with reason, thereby becoming like non-human animals. Now, I myself think it's a mistake to equate human material satisfaction with animal happiness. I mean, we should be so lucky. I mean, there's a vast medieval literature of envy of non-human animals, mostly having to do with the fact that when they go for something, it tends to be a good sort of thing to go for. And that's not always how it is with us, sadly. Our sensual and material lives are not easily separated from our lot as intellectual animals. Be that as it may, we are in the same boat with other animals in at least this sense. The goods of this world are transitory and contingent. According to authoritative sources that I respect, in seeking happiness, we humans seek something stable and lasting, that cannot be taken from us. Now, as far as I know, when one is inclined to make this argument, one discounts both a venerable Spartan sort of thought about it being a fine thing to go out in a blaze of glory on the battlefield, thereby securing one's memory for all time, and also the less venerable idea that there's a lot to be said for living fast and dying young. Now, I'm willing to bite those bullets, willing to fly in the face of those two things. Sticking to a different venerable sort of thought, one might ask, what does it profit a man if he wins major athletic competitions without doping, gains lucrative endorsements, fame, and ample opportunity for pleasure, but loses his soul? The answer is supposed to be that it profits him not at all. But it's surely understandable that gaining whatever counts for someone as the world through sustained and persistent effort against significant odds is not going to look like nothing. And health, wealth, honor, and delight have been the stuff of human pursuit for a very long time. Worse, if your way of making sense of why it is that people go for anything in a serious way is that they think that they're going for what will bring happiness, a Jeremy Bentham sort of thought that has been repackaged by contemporary neo-Aristotelians, then the fact of serious pursuit on the part of many people at least suggests that worldly goods have been the substance of a lot of actual pursuit of happiness. Worse yet, witnesses to these supposedly vain efforts have not exactly turned away from such things in disgust upon seeing what happens when people get them. Yes, trying to be as shiny and pretty and well-liked as possible for as long as possible is hard work, and the passage of time is never your best friend. But that all by itself shouldn't suggest that the people who are pretty and shiny and adored were going for the wrong thing. I mean, serious scholarship, science, work for social justice, these kinds of things also take up a lot of time and effort and are never complete or lasting, whatever headway you make with them. You know, that hasn't made people turn up their noses at these pursuits, even though everyone in these areas knows that they are spending their lives going for stuff that has a shelf life and seeking goals that they cannot achieve under their own steam. Now, viewed through the lenses of even the kind of potted histories that I know, any tie that has connected health, wealth, honor, and, I don't know, sensual delight, or science, scholarship, and social justice, for that matter, to religious practice seems at best coincidental, if you think about it. It isn't impossible that these things all might line up. Take bliss, for instance. I could have ecstatic mystic experience that healed my body and brought wealth and honor and knowledge my way and put me in an excellent position to inspire collective work for common good. But I will be dancing in a fool's paradise if I expect these things to come of my graceful, whirling acts of worship. I've been watching a lot of films of Sufi dance lately. It's sort of, it's kind of stunning and arresting. But you wouldn't do it thinking that all that stuff was going to line up for you, and they don't. Let us leave ordinary health, wealth, sensuality, intellectual or social pursuits, and the stuff of worldly success to one side, noticing that in doing so, we rule out things that many people have regarded as crucial for happiness in this life. Allow that not only does it feel like there has to be more than finding a place for myself in a complex world, more than finding productive and rewarding outlets for my talents, more than any health or wealth or recognition that I might enjoy, more than success, more than friends and family, basically, more than the things that many of my people take to be worth having. And suppose that there really is more than this. And suppose that I want whatever that more is. Is there a way to the elusive more through religious practice? Now, obviously, the answer is going to depend on the variety of religious practice in question and the character of the elusive more. Take Christianity, for instance. By the lights of the varieties of Christian religious practice familiar to me, it would be a strange thing to turn to Christianity for temporal happiness. In the revealed literature, followers are frequently told to expect to be reviled for their faith. All are charged with obedience to commandments that are hard to obey. All are charged with loving neighbors who are inconvenient and needy. All are expected to fail in doing what they are supposed to do individually and collectively, and no one is supposed to be content with failure. Religious practice is supposed to help nourish and build the faith that anyone will need if she decides to go in for Christianity in a serious way, and in the early days of the church at least, there was not an obvious casual way offered for ordinary people who were attracted to the message and understandably concerned about the more strenuous side of what was just called the way. Now, I, of course, agree with many folks in this room that there is a crucial link between this kind of religion and happiness, and that if you accept the points of linkage, you ought to conclude that it is, in fact, crucial for happiness. I'm going to lay out the picture, the points, a little bit differently than Father Thomas Joseph did. That's on this handout. It goes kind of like this. Human beings are intellectual, social animals and creatures in the first instance. As intellectual, social animals, they are, for whatever reason, disordered. Some of us think the fall, maybe. What they seek because it appears as a kind of thing it will be good to go for, as something that's good for a human being. Their urges and feelings and appetites want to be reasonable, but rarely are. They want their lives, individually and socially, to make a kind of sense that lives rarely do. They cannot live long or well without significant social cooperation. They often find themselves at odds with their fellows, and even when they agree that a way of addressing social tensions is desirable, they need not share a vision about how to order their social lives and pursuits to make things better. And any shared vision that they manage need not be obviously practicable for them. As creatures, they have deep need not only to make sense of themselves, their lives, and each other, not only to find ways of discerning and pursuing genuine human good and avoiding what is genuinely bad, that is, to be right with themselves and right with each other on however large or small a scale, but also to be right with the divine source of their lives and world. Religion aims at providing established channels for helping people be right with themselves, with each other, and with divinity. Sound religious practice provides channels through which to pursue harmony in all of these relations. But insofar as religious organizations are human institutions, carried, held, transmitted, and engaged by human beings, they are not free of the kinds of disorder that marks human life generally. For all that, religion is what we have if we mean to pursue a kind of harmony with each other and divinity that is, I happen to think, a core human need, and seeking happiness in some way that cuts divinity out of the picture is going to be seeking one or another kind of fulfillment that will leave the spiritual need unsatisfied. Basically, however, if you don't think that there's a core need to be right with divinity built into human life, and you notice that religious practice can be very hard and can make you unpopular, it is hard to see the link between religion and happiness, at least in terms of the varieties of religious practice I've encountered. So you'll notice that I'm with Father Thomas Joseph and Aquinas, and also with Professor Frey, with a couple of caveats for folks who are turned away from seeing any role for an essential tie to the sacred or divine in human life. Thank you.